Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who understands this war brilliantly and writes lucidly and copiously about it is our first guest. His name is J.R. Nyquist. Jeff is one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio, the author of a number of important books, including The Origins of the Fourth World War, and most recently, The Fool and His Enemy. He blogs at jrnyquist.blog, and you can follow him, as I do, at jrnyquist. It's good to have you with us, Jeff, as always, especially against the backdrop of the sorts of things we're going to be discussing in the course of today's program, as we often do, namely the threats foreign and domestic to our country, particularly those emanating from or aided and abetted by, at the minimum, the Chinese Communist Party. And I'd like to just set the stage for these conversations by asking you to remind us, what is the Chinese Communist Party's agenda with respect to the United States?
Well, they want to destroy the United States as a great power, and they want to fill the gap. And they would like to, you know, if defector testimony is true, Colonel Stanislav Lunev, speeches like Chiao Chen's secret speech, indicate that they want to take over North America. They want to dominate the entire Pacific. They want to control the farmland here. China is seriously overpopulated. They can't publicly talk about it because then it makes them sound like the Nazis or the Imperial Japanese, who of course, complained about not having enough Lebensraum or living space. But they really have a problem. Their country is polluted. Their rivers are dying. They're sitting on 1.4 billion people. They've got these kind of problems, and they view us as their main enemy. If they want to expand, you know, or have a war, they got to face us. So why not take what they need from us?
Yeah, and possibly do that first, as you've been pointing out. And we'll talk a little bit more about some of the other things that are in the offing here shortly with Joe Bosco. But staying with their objective, destroying the United States, Jeff, how would you characterize the kinds of techniques that they're using against us? It seems as though they are varied and comprehensive. Remind us about unrestricted warfare as the doctrine that they're pursuing and what it might mean in terms of things that we should be alive to that are not perhaps as obvious as they should be.
Well, this is a technique the Russians use too. I mean, the idea is, of course, that you do everything short of open warfare to damage another country. And the thing is that it's not always obvious that things that look like they're every day can be attacks, like, for example, an attack on the dollar, where we've got all these Chinese operators operating hedge funds, for example. This Archegos fund collapsed recently, doing major damage to some of our banks. That was run by Mr. Wang. So Mr. Wang was, a Chinese national with connections to the People's Republic of China. Why did they let him have $100 billion worth of leverage on our investment market? You know, and there's Zero Hedge said was there's 20 to 30 other funds like this controlled by Chinese nationals in our markets that could be bombs that could go off. And, inflation and deflation are weapons. When the government produces a lot of extra money, it gets soaked up by the markets, and then it creates what you call a crack-up boom. That is, you got an overinflated market. It's a bubble. It needs to burst. When that bubble bursts, it takes banks, it takes businesses, it takes all kinds of good stuff along with it, and destroys everything.
A related point, Jeff, is, I presume, something that Michelle Bachmann warned about on Steve Bannon's War Room Pandemic program yesterday afternoon. She said that Joe Biden is actually waging war against the United States, and specifically against our dollar with the kinds of programs, policies, legislative initiatives that are generating a lot of that bubble building excess cash. Talk a little bit about that and how that would tie in with the Chinese agenda of taking down not just our country, but the dollar as the reserve currency of the world.
Well, of course, massive spending bills in the trillions. I mean, already the federal government cannot contain its spending. We've got this pandemic spending. We've got a real threat to the economy with the lockdowns. Then you're going to add $2.3 trillion in spending. What happens is now the government's at the point where it's not like people are buying bonds. You know, the Federal Reserve is basically, I mean, we're basically buying our own bonds, creating money out of thin air, basically. And that is where you get inflation. And the reason we haven't suffered really serious inflation is because of the reserve currency status. Everybody overseas uses our money, especially in the oil industry, and that absorbs our inflation. That is, we export our inflation to other countries. Well, if that inflation becomes really annoying, if we're really irresponsible like this bill would be, other countries are going to say, we're not putting up with this. We're not absorbing these costs, because basically when we overspend like that, we're taxing other countries. We're taxing our allies and the people that use dollars. And one day they're just going to say, we don't want dollars anymore.
You know, one of the other things that you've pointed out, which I think is really striking, is I think you've said this on our program, that if people don't feel that we are defending them as a consideration in deciding whether to hold dollars and thereby support our ability to defend them, because one of the things that would be over the side, presumably very quickly, if we have to pay higher interest rates for the borrowing that we must do, is a lot of federal spending, including for the Defense Department, would be greatly reduced. That deal, that bargain, may no longer operate, and that would further pressure countries to abandon the dollar as the reserve currency of the world, would it not?
Well, yeah, it would. I mean, look, to make the point even stronger, if you are doing all this infrastructure spending, $2.3 trillion, you're crowding out defense spending. And if you have some problem with your banks, there's no extra money for anything else. That is, every other form of investment in your economy is crowded out. And the government sector is taking over. And that's going to include affect technology development, future investment in our own industries and future jobs. But the defense spending being crowded out, if you've got this government commitment to non-defense spending, then the government says, well, we don't have the money. We can't afford a new jet or a new plane. But you see countries like Australia and Japan and South Korea and Western Europe, it's like, well, the Americans aren't able to defend us anymore. Why are we supporting the dollar?
All of this comes together, perhaps, in a new dynamic that moves us inexorably towards conflict. We'll be talking momentarily with Joe Bosco about that prospect in the Western Pacific. Jeff Nyquist, we have to leave you with that at the moment. Thank you for your time today and for the insights that you share with us each week. We're deeply appreciative, and we'll look forward to talking with you next week. Next up again, Joseph Bosco, former desk officer for China in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, about coming conflict, perhaps, in the Western Pacific. Adam Moore, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and we are joined by one of the men I have come to admire most for his clarity about the nature of the danger that we face from the Chinese Communist Party. His name is Joseph Bosco. He served as the country desk officer for China in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, among other capacities in the Pentagon. He is also a fellow with the Institute for Korea-America Studies and the Institute for Taiwan-America Studies. He writes prolifically, often at The Hill, about these issues, and it's always terrific to be able to catch up with him, particularly in the wake of an important new piece entitled "With Salami Slicing and Swarming Tactics, China's aggression continues. That's at the Hill at the moment. Joe, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Thanks very much, Frank. Nice to be with you.
I want to drill down on a number of the points that you make in this article, if I can, Joe, because we talk a lot about China on this program, as you know, often with you. We've talked a lot about the dangers that it poses in a number of respects, but increasingly there is concern, and you certainly are exhibiting it, about China's use of military force, at least prospective use of military force, for the purpose of accomplishing its longstanding objectives, including, notably, Taiwan. Talk a bit about what they have in mind for Taiwan and what we're seeing in the way of such exercising, at least, of military capabilities that suggest the forcible acquisition of Taiwan may be in the offing.
Well, we've certainly known for decades, really, what their intentions are about Taiwan. They told Nixon and Kissinger that back in 71 and 72, that they intend to take Taiwan one way or the other. But I don't think they are suicidal. I don't think they would want to risk everything that they've been developing over the last 40 years, with our help, I should say, for the sake of trying to take Taiwan. They intend to take it, and they believe that the West will buckle under to economic, psychological, and military pressure and allow it to happen without a major conflict. Obviously, our task, ours being the United States and the West, should be to make it clear to Taiwan that that is not a possibility, that the only way they can even think of taking over that democratic society is by the use of force, and that we will respond appropriately. We have not made that clear over the years. No administration has. The Trump administration has come the closest to it, and has revolutionized the world's thinking about communist China, and that's all to the good. Whether the Biden administration will continue to follow the Trump policies, as so far they have indicated they are willing to do, still is an open question. But unless we resist the use of force, even at its initial phases, by the Chinese, we're in for something more troublesome.
That's for sure. And let's drill down on a couple of points you've made there, Joe. The military forces that are now being routinely exercised in and around the Taiwanese littoral is something that we haven't seen before, certainly not at these levels. Talk a bit about the carrier battle group that's exercising out there now, the various flights that have been operating, some of which have circumnavigated the island, but getting into its air defense zone, not just, you know, crossing the center line of the Taiwan Straits. Two thoughts here. One, are these indeed heightened actions beyond anything we've seen before? And are they designed, do you think, to desensitize the defenders of the island, and us for that matter, as to what may now be in the offing?
Yeah, I think both the points are valid. Both things are true. They're sending a message. They're signaling that they're serious about taking Taiwan, and they're also getting us, that is the world and Taiwan itself, used to the demonstration of force as a regular routine military exercise. They've been conducting exercises in the South China Sea, even in the Yellow Sea and East China Sea. And I think their thinking is that the more we see their planes, their ships in the area, the more we will assume that is the new normal. And one day that new normal may suddenly become something more sinister as they encircle Taiwan with their ships and planes, and we get used to that fact and just say it's a regular occurrence, and suddenly Taiwan is blockaded. The ships don't move. The planes continue and intensify, and other external powers are unable to come in to to assist Taiwan. That's the kind of scenario I worry about, where they in effect institute a blockade or quarantine around Taiwan. And they're doing that around the Philippines as well, and now in the Senkaku of Japan. So it's their new technique, and it is an escalation of what they've been threatening to do, things like that. Now they're actually doing them. They're hoping that we will knuckle under, and that Taiwan will say that the better course of valor is to accept Chinese communist rule. And there's no indication that the people of Taiwan are inclined to do that. So, as we've been saying for years, we're talking about an irresistible force and an immovable object, and it's happening.
Joe, one of the things that I hadn't heard before and saw in your piece is the Taiwanese are no longer scrambling their aircraft to intercept these Chinese intrusions. You mentioned that this is to avoid exhausting its personnel and wearing down its equipment. But again, this suggests a significant erosion in the posture of the Taiwanese, as seen by Beijing, I assume, and raises a question that I really want to focus in on now with you for the duration of this chat. What should we be doing about all this right now? Clarity about our commitment to defending the island, I know, is top of mind for you. Talk a little bit about that, but beyond that, what should be the U.S. government's posture, and most especially, what should we be doing to help with the Taiwanese posture?
Well, we certainly should be providing them as many of the defensive arms, and not merely defensive, but counter-deterrent arms that they need. There's talk and there's deliberation now on whether Taiwan should develop counter-strike capabilities to hit the mainland. That was something that we talked about years ago, and the feeling in the Defense Department was that no, this was too provocative. I think that was a mistake, and I think that there's rethinking going on both in the U.S. and Taiwan as to what it should do. We should be providing weapons, technical assistance. There should be high-level consultation between our military and their military. Just the other day, I think a decision was made for some collaboration between the Taiwan Coast Guard and the U.S. Coast Guard. That's a good step in the right direction. There should be more of that. We should be conducting routine military exercises, initially under the guise of humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. Taiwan has got tremendous capabilities there. We should be doing the same thing that China is doing, that is letting Beijing know that there are going to be regular demonstrations of U.S. military cooperation with Taiwan in the Taiwan Strait and in the area generally. And then finally, of course, to your point, there should be strategic clarity. There should be no doubt in Beijing's mind that any use of force against Taiwan, and that includes a blockade or a quarantine, any of that will result in a confrontation between the U.S. and China. And no one can predict how the escalation process will work in that kind of a scenario. So they've got to think, we've got to make Beijing think long and hard about the risks they're incurring with this aggressive policy of theirs. So far, we made steps in that direction. Trump said, I think, in an interview in his last months in office, that he was asked what the U.S. would do if China attacked Taiwan, and he said something to the effect that China knows what I'm going to do. They know it, which means he has conveyed some kind of a message to China that there will be a military response. Well, his administration is no longer in office. It's time for the Biden administration to step up and make very clear to China what the consequences would be of an attack on Taiwan.
Yeah. You know, Joe, there's so much more to talk about, but we're out of time. I just wanted to close with this final thought. I am concerned that Joe Biden may have communicated his ideas, his thoughts, his intentions with respect to Taiwan in the course of a two-hour conversation that he had a few months ago with Xi Jinping shortly after coming to office. And I think we need to see the transcript of that call so that we have some sense of what he said, or perhaps what was at least likely interpreted to be his position by the Chinese Communist Party and its leader. This is a topic to which we will return with you, I hope, very soon, Joe. Thank you for this update and for the great work you do, among other places, at The Hill. I know you keep it up. You keep us briefed on your thinking. It's vitally important. Next up, we will speak with Mike Gonzalez of the Heritage Foundation about identity politics and what it's doing to our country and our Constitution. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it is with great privilege and pleasure that I say we are joined by a man I admire greatly. He is a fellow at the Heritage Foundation with the distinction of being, in fact, the E Pluribus Unum Fellow, sponsored by the Angeles Arundondo Foundation. He has, I think, contributed mightily over the course of his career, both as a journalist, much of his time spent overseas reporting on events in Europe, Asia, and Latin America, but also in the administration of President George W. Bush, where he worked with Chris Cox at the Securities and Exchange Commission, and in the State Department's European Bureau. His name is Michael Gonzalez, and he has been prolifically contributing, I'm pleased to say, to the public policy debate, notably with a really important book that came out last summer entitled The Plot to Change America: How Identity Politics is Dividing the Land of the Free. And he has a new book which is available for pre-order now, coming out this fall, entitled Black Lives Matter: The Making of a New Marxist Revolution. He hails originally from a communist country that taught him a lot about these Marxists and their revolutions, namely Cuba, and he is always a welcome guest here. Mike, it's so good to have you, and thank you for giving us two blocks to drill down on some of these really important topics. We're so grateful.
Frank, the pleasure is all mine. We've been friends for a long time. You're a veteran in the fights to defend freedom. I'm always very happy to be on with you.
Thank you. Let me ask you to walk us through what I consider to be a particularly helpful sort of short course on the topics that you developed at greater length in your book, The Plot to Change America. It appeared in the Philanthropy Roundtable back in December, and it was entitled The Identity Politics Policy Portfolio. First of all, define the term for us, will you? Identity politics and its provenance, which I didn't know anything about. It was fascinating to read about.
Thank you. Yes, identity politics is really the reimagining of America as a confederation of categories, not really a nation united for common purposes of people where race and ethnicity, national origin, and sex are really secondary or tertiary to the common citizenship that we all have, and the care for the national interest, both domestic and international. Identity politics relies on these categories. At first, it divides the country into these categories, but the important thing is that a lot of the categories will be categories of the quote-unquote oppressed. It's a way of seeing life as power dynamics. You have the oppressors on one side and the oppressed on the other. Another important part of it is that there is no truth. History, the things that have happened, are not really truth. They're just a narrative, and as they put it, a hegemonic narrative that must be driven out, must be dismantled, must be problematized, to use their word, and replaced with a counter narrative. And then the last thing that is very important to identity politics is the victimhood culture component. The fact that you draw your dignity, your claim on rights, your claim on rewards from your degree of victimhood. And if you have many different sources of victimhood, then you have even more of a claim on rewards.
Mike Gonzalez, you talk about the Combahee River Collective Statement of 1977 as a kind of alternative constitution. I think it's where this phrase or the term identity politics was first used. And what strikes me about it, and you capture many of the themes that are much in evidence today, dating back to that time, is the virulent hatred, really, for America that is exhibited by these feminist black women who put this statement together initially and have now really become sort of the defining themes of the left in America at the moment.
Yeah, and not just feminist black women, but communists. They themselves say in that statement that they're Marxists, and they want to add race to the Marxist the Marxian analysis of society and the economy. This is a very important thing. For a very long time, for centuries even, because it all begins in 1848, America has been seen from outside and from inside as the nation of freedom, the standard bearer of liberty. And notwithstanding all the difficulties we have had, that is the case. And as a result of being a nation that waves the standard of liberty, it is seen as the ultimate anti-communist nation. The nation that stood up to the Soviet Union, sure, Britain was a very good ally in that war, in that Cold War. Israel was a very good ally. We had the European allies on the continent who were good to different degrees in that fight. But America was the leader. America led not just because of its power, its economic power and its military power, but because it was the nation of liberty. In fact, you could say, and I would definitely say, that is economic and military power was the result of our attachment to liberty. And the people who are the Marxists, the people who want to have a Marxist dispensation in America, who want to have central planning, want to have a planned economy, and that's what they want, a command economy, who think capitalism is bad because as they put it, they think it's racist, they hate America because it has produced all of this.
It stands in the way of the triumph of their agenda globally, doesn't it? And to this point, Mike, when you're talking about racism as an element of the Marxist attack on our country and an attack from within, you introduced in another of your recent pieces the term of the long march through the institutions. And I want to talk to you about the place where you were pointing to it most immediately, because it's top of mind. But just introduce us to that term. Where did that come from, and how has it manifested itself to this point? The Long March.
Well, the Long March through the institutions was a concept devised by Rudi Dutschke, who was a West German activist, a radical, really, a very violent guy. Obviously, that was an allusion to Mao's Long March in China in the 30s in a shooting war with the Kuomintang, when the communists spent many months marching either through the snows of China or through the heat of China as they fought the nationalists. Rudi Dutschke says, we're going to also have a long march. This one's going to be through the institutions. It's going to be peaceful, but we're going to take over the institutions. The concept was endorsed by his mentor, Herbert Marcuse, who was an academic of the Frankfurt School, who was a critical theorist, out of which comes critical race theory, by the way. We can get into that. And in what what Duchka and Marcuse meant was taking over the academy, the university, taking over the entertainment industry, Hollywood, taking over all of media. All these things, to my mind, have been pretty much accomplished. We're there. They've succeeded. And now the new battle lines are the corporate world, the church, and the military.
And all three are very much under assault. And talk a little bit about, if you would, the particular point that you've raised about the march now in the corporations. This is a topic that you've addressed at the Heritage Foundation in a piece on March 26th. Georgia comes to mind as a prime example of this syndrome. But talk more generally about how this has been accomplished, Mike, and how you see the consolidation of the gains that have been made sort of over, well, years now, I guess, to really dominate and bend to their purposes, the power of America's corporations.
Yeah, that was a book review that I wrote for another good book. After you buy my book, The Plot to Change America, buy Stephen Sukup's book, The Dictatorship of Woke Capital. And I reviewed that book for the Liberty Institute's Law and Liberty. And he really makes it, it's a very short book, by the way, and so it really packs a punch. And he, Sukup, goes over how the left, Frank, as you know, is very very crafty and very committed. They have staying power. They stay in for the long haul. And the way Sukup makes a very cogent case that they have taken over the process by which corporations are governed, that is publicly listed companies, right? Companies that issue shares. They have to have an annual meeting. They have to have a proxy statement that they file with the SEC, with the Securities and Exchange Commission, which I used to work. There are proxy services companies, proxy advisory services companies, and the left has taken over all of these processes, and therefore have really exerted a outsized power over corporate America. Activists buy shares just for the purpose of disrupting shareholder meetings, the annual meetings, and introducing proposals that will push the corporation to the left. And that's what has happened.
And we're now seeing this in a lot of different ways, manifested in terms of changes of board, changes of policy, changes even of the business model of these corporations in the interest of advancing so-called environment, social justice, and governance, among other things, part of the agenda of the radical left. Mike, we have to take a short break. We're going to come right back with more with Michael Gonzalez about, among other things, critical race theory and what it means for the rest of us if it is in fact part of the institutions that we rely upon to make America our country. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are continuing this incredibly important conversation with Mike Gonzalez of the Heritage Foundation. He is its E Pluribus Unum Fellow, a term that, of course, is Latin for one out of many. And what we're talking about here, the fruit of some very important research and extraordinarily compelling writing that Mike has done, notably in his book, The Plot to Change America, and a whole slew of articles related to it, is the determined effort to undermine that concept by the radical left in favor of creating, out of one, many, and for the ultimate purpose of destroying the one, the nation, the United States of America. Mike, again, thank you for your time today. You were setting the stage for a conversation that we really need to have about one of the most insidious instruments the left is now using to move this identity politics agenda forward through the institutions. And you talked about the church. You talked about the military. You talked about corporate America as specific targets in this long march. Tell us about critical race theory and the training that is now being done in these places to advance identity politics and subvert our country.
Thanks, Frank. And by the way, you described it beautifully. And, you know, Al Gore once said that in pluribus unum meant out of one many. He actually said that in the 90s once.
A Freudian slip.
Yeah. So, everything that is happening. I mean, so race has become all the rage in America, right? And it is through critical race theory that it is happening. And your listeners who are parents will know and will note with concern, and they should be concerned, that the children are being indoctrinated into these trainings that divide the classroom between races, something which I believe is illegal. And it violates the Title VII, Title VI. It violates the 14th Amendment, and people should sue. So what it is a Marxist thing at heart, right? It is born out of critical theory. Critical theory was a school of thought that began in Europe in the 30s, which was a Marxist school, not only a Marxist and communist school of thought. They actually went to bat for the Soviet Union, even at the height of the 30s, at the height of all the horrors of Stalin. And then they were too embarrassed and had to like step away from the Soviet Union, but continued to try to preach Marxism. And what it is, critical race theory, the important part is critical, is just a way of criticizing all the norms, all the traditions, and all the institutions of the West and of the United States in particular, in order to change America, in order to destroy these institutions and put in what they want. They actually, if you read Marcuse, if you read Horkheimer, they believe that a planned economy, an economy that is planned not by individuals but by government, is much more rational. It's much better. Of course, that is nonsense. I have lived in a planned economy. Our economy, capitalism, produces bread. A planned economy produces bread lines because the price discovery mechanism goes out the window. Supply and demand goes out the window. All the things that produce all the wealth that we have goes out the window. But they don't think that. They think that capitalism, that working for somebody else, it means wage slavery, that you become a slave and you continue to be a slave. It's just a sweeter word for slavery. And of course, it baffles, it beggars belief, right? Because slavery actually means working for somebody for no money. But they really hate capitalism.
Which bears a lot more resemblance to the socialist or communist system than it does to the capitalist system. But Mike, let me just turn quickly, because we're going to run out of time with you before we run out of things to talk about. We'd like to get you back for another full hour to really talk about all of these issues in greater detail. I did want to introduce our audience to some of the themes that you work through in your new book that will be out shortly. And again, that's entitled Black Lives Matter, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution. And the key piece here that I guess I wanted to get at is, as you see it, when these Marxists use identity politics, use critical race theory, use these institutions, is their agenda ever anything other than taking down the United States? And to what degree is that a purpose that they share? And perhaps are they aided and abetted by foreign enemies of the United States? And I'm thinking in particular of the Chinese Communist Party, which, as you noted in a recent piece at Heritage, is essentially an ideological kissing cousin of the American radical left.
Well, thanks for saying that. And if your listeners want to look up my new book, it's BLM. It's not Black Lives, BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution. You can look for it on Amazon. Mike Gonzalez is already in presale. And look, the leaders of the Black Lives Matters organizations, especially the Black Lives Matters, the Global Fund, the BLM Global Fund, and the Movement for Black Lives, the leaders of these groups are Marxists. They say they're Marxists. They have always been Marxists. And you're quite right. By the way, the concept is unimpeachable. The concept of Black Lives Matter, as I always say, if you don't think Black Lives Matter, I don't want to talk to you. Black Lives, of course, do matter, and I have no problem saying that. It's the organizations themselves that are led by Marxists. Alicia Garza herself says that what she wants to do is dismantle the organizing principle of our society. But Patrice Couleur says that they're all trained Marxists. Opal Tometi has gone down to Caracas and signed a manifesto, wrote a manifesto, praising Chavez's participatory democracy. In other words, they don't like our representative system. They don't like our economic system. They want to dismantle the organizing principle of American society. We need to be very...
Including the nuclear family, as they call it.
Yeah, oh, of course. I mean, but they take that... Who do they take that from? Marx and Engels. They themselves wrote in the manifesto that they wanted to abolish the family, quote unquote. They see the family as, and rightly so, the family is the building unit, not only of our economic system, but all of our society. If you want to make our society sick, make the family sick. And they're well on their way to doing that.
And conversely, if you want to take down the society, have children turning against their parents, turning them into the party, turning them into the state. And you saw that firsthand, I'm sure, in Cuba.
Oh, right.
Back in the day.
I have very strong memories, very, very bad memories exactly of that. My parents, they could not keep secrets away from us, but they had to say, you know, they're going to ask you to turn us in. And if you stay in school, any of the things we say here at home, they're going to put us in prison, and that'll be the end of us. So I didn't really have much of a childhood. I had to understand very quickly what was going on.
It brings it home that you've actually experienced this. This is not a hypothetical. This is not some sort of histrionics about Marxism. This is how it operates. And so in your new book, you're warning that this revolutionary activity in the hands of communists using race and identity politics against our country is not just a thing, it's a reality, and it is on the march, would you say, in our country. And very quickly, we've got less than a minute, what would you be most urgently recommending we do about it, Mike Gonzalez?
Well, you have to create the communications environment. You have to create the right environment of opinion, so that even the wrong leaders will do the right thing. I'm paraphrasing Milton Friedman there. We are eventually going to have to elect a leader or leaders from any party who understand what we're going through, who understand that we're being communized, that they are Marxist people with Marxist ideas that are teaching our children, that are controlling the things we do, and that this is an alien ideology, something that really has nothing. It's the opposite of what the founders intended. It is the opposite of what our founding fathers fought for. It's the opposite of the recent people immigrated here for since the 1800s. This is not America. They want to change America, the title of
Fundamentally Transform. Yeah, exactly right. Mike Gonzalez, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for this very important conversation, and I look forward to continuing with you at greater length in the near future. Come back to us for that purpose very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.